So this evening, for the talk and discussion, I want to continue with the theme that I brought up last week, where I gave 10 foundations for practicing with conflict. And I invited people to explore during the last week how you yourself might practice the conflict. And I right away last time defined conflict as, or difference, it's really conflict could be defined as a difference between values or goals or strategies, not necessarily involving hostility or aggression or hard feelings. I can have a very, personable discussion that around, what should we do this evening? We may have a conflict between doing this or doing that. And it's a real difference. It's a kind of a conflict, but we can approach it very personally, or personably, I should say. And so that definition is really crucial. And then I invited people to explore, and I talked about the spectrum of conflicts ranging from inner conflict to, should I stay in this relationship or not? Should I stay in this home or not? Should I do this or that this evening, this morning, and so forth, to an interpersonal conflict, to a conflict in a group or organization, to a larger social conflict. And my claim was that we bring our spiritual practice to any kind of conflict, from an inner conflict to a larger conflict, in the same way. And what I did was I identified what I called 10 foundations of practicing with conflict. That was the content last time I looked at that, and I invited people to examine how conflicts appeared. How many people did that, at least some, during the last week? Yeah, fantastic. So that'll be a really good background. And I think what I want to do is also send to Bill to put on the website the document that lists the 10 foundations, so you can have that. And I'll mention them tonight. And so what I thought of doing, a little bit of a risk, what I thought of doing was something which has been really important to me, which is applying the 10 foundations to a big conflict. In particular, Israel-Palestine. Are you ready for that? But applying the 10 foundations, and what I'll claim is that the way of practicing is the same. And what's crucial here is that I'm going to talk about our practice. I'm not going to give an analysis of the situation per se, although some analysis will come in. But I'm going to talk about how to apply this. And I'm doing so, I think, for two larger reasons, not just the further understanding of that particular conflict, but how do we bring our practice to a large social issue? Is our practice just about our own personal experience? Right? Sometimes we might think that. It's often the way that practice is presented. It's primarily about meditation. Is our understanding relevant for larger conflicts? I'm going to say that it's very relevant. Even though few people bring anything like spiritual practice to larger conflicts, let alone smaller conflicts. And the second reason I was thinking of bringing up this issue is that particularly during the holiday times, we may have discussions about larger issues, not necessarily Israel-Palestine, but it might be about differences of views. Anyone have relatives with different views than you? Okay. You may be having discussions. And so what I'm going to be pointing to is also that these 10 foundations can give us guidance for those kind of situations. So it really is part of our practice, and it can be an exciting, can be really an exciting dimension of practice. And I'll be having some discussion after a talk. It'll be a relatively short talk, partly because of the timing, but I still hope to say some important things that can give us a sense of how to bring these 10 foundations to a large issue, which has been, for many of us, center stage. So here are the 10 foundations again. I'll mention them very briefly, and then I'll go through them and apply them to the situation. The first is ground in the core teachings. When you want to bring your practice to differences or conflicts, keep a grounding in the core teachings. And I'll mention some of the relevant teachings later when I turn to the actual conflict I'll be working with. So work with the teachings, ground in the core teachings. Secondly, well, actually, the next area is three inner foundations. The second is to know what one's own style or conditioning related to conflict is, particularly whether we have tendencies to be conflict avoidant, which is probably the majority of us, or sometimes the other alternative is conflict indulgent, where I just jump into things and say whatever comes to mind. Neither of those is particularly skillful. Those are the two dominant forms of conditioning. It's helpful to know what ours is. The third is one of the pillars of our practice, which is practicing with difficult thoughts, emotions, and body states, because those, of course, come up in the context of conflicts. The fourth is bringing in the heart practices, loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, very, very crucial for being skillful with conflict, both sometimes during the actual experience of a conflict and also at other times. And then the next six are more outer dimensions of conflict. The fifth of these guidelines is remembering the teachings of the Buddha, that everyone has Buddha nature, that everyone has the seeds of awakening, that everyone in their essence has the roots of love and wisdom, and that's our basic nature. Related to that is the sixth, that we want to really have that spirit of aspiring towards what Dr. King called the beloved community. Because everyone has Buddha nature, we might say everyone is deserving of metta. We have an approach to conflict in which we want to have what we could call a win-win resolution, in which the deep and genuine needs of everyone are met. That's a goal in relation to conflict, which comes out of our practice. Obviously, the dominant model in the world is not that. The dominant world is, I want my side to win. A dharmic approach to conflict goes against that and says we want everyone to win. And we try to avoid getting things caught in polarization. The seventh guideline is bringing in the ethical dimension, particularly non-harming, non-violence, and so forth. This could also manifest in the way that we develop conflict guidelines for a group or an organization. The eighth is that empathy is foundational. Tuning in to what matters for another person is at the heart of our conflict work. And again, it's related to the spirit of metta, keeping the heart open for everyone. Not easy, right? Not easy for many of our interpersonal conflicts. So this is why it's a practice. The ninth is related to that, developing skillful speech practice in conflicts. So you can see how these are bringing in many dimensions of our practice, our meditation, our ethics, our speech. And the 10th is sort of an extension of the ethics. It's bringing in, at the social level, the non-harming, which can be expressed as non-violence. So how to apply this to Israel-Palestine, or generally to a large social issue? I think working with these 10 foundations is the way to go. And I want to really refer to one of them I hope in our discussion, we can also have the spirit of having guidelines to be respectful of each other, caring, and have it possible to disagree. I'm very welcome to have a disagreement with anything that I say, but we can talk about it, as it were, with empathy for everyone. So just a little bit about my own personal background. Probably as most of you know, my ancestry is Jewish. My grandparents were all immigrants. I was thinking of doing some screen sharing. I had a photograph of my great-grandparents soon after they came from Eastern Europe to New York. And I have a great-grandfather with a huge beard and an old-style hat. Would have been fun to show. So that is my ancestry. And I've also, again, as many of you know, had two long teaching trips in Israel in 2017 and 19, where I traveled around the country. I met with a number of people, saw a lot of places myself. Also during those trips, I made three trips to the West Bank. So I saw things up close. I was told that through those three trips, I had way more experience of the West Bank and of Palestinian life than most Israelis, sad to say. That's what I was told, right? And I've also, partly from those trips, I felt a commitment, really a wish to help in some ways. And I've been helping in some small ways. I've been asked to consult a few times with the Israeli Insight Meditation organization. And I've met with teachers. I met and gave some guidance to teachers when they were wanting to bring in the Israel-Palestine conflict into their teaching. A lot of the teachers have been activists, but that's been separate from their teaching. So I met there. I've also helped in some small ways with fundraising for a mindfulness center in the West Bank called the Garden of Hope, a place for Palestinians and Israelis to meet, guided by a Palestinian student of Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, these are things which don't appear in the newspaper. Right? These are happenings. That's part of the background. So first, ground in the core teachings. And particularly relevant are the teachings that we've looked at a lot when we look at reactivity, the teachings of the two arrows, the teaching that when we have something unpleasant or painful happen, we will tend to have reactivity. We will tend to shoot a second arrow as if that would help. Very relevant teaching, because there's tremendous pain connected with Israel-Palestine. And one version of the two arrows teaching is to see, I receive pain, I'm in a conflict, I inflict pain on you, as if that would help, right? There are other dimensions, of course, but the two arrows teaching is very relevant. The teaching from the Dhammapada, hatred only ends with non-hatred, sometimes translated as love. hatred never ends through hatred. And seeing the world through the lens of greed, hatred, and delusion. And, you know, in that context, we can see how really there is so much trauma historically on both sides that in many ways, the Zionist project and the development of Israel was a response to 2,000 years of anti-Semitism with the Holocaust, probably the most extreme event in human history, which really spurred particularly the United Nations to help establish the State of Israel. And then on the Palestinian side, things were done throughout the 20th century with very little or no consideration of what's important for them. And so one line which I have, which is sort of a version of the two arrows, is that Jewish people jumped out of the burning building of Europe and landed on the Palestinians. It's a way that we can understand it. And if you would look at the history, you'll see massive trauma on both sides. And when there's trauma, there's continual repetition. You know, I looked at a analysis of the Israel-Palestine situation from the writing of one of my teachers, Johann Galton, from the year 2000. It could have been written yesterday. This is what he said in the year 2000. The prognosis is the same as it was 50 years ago. And listen to this. Oscillation between the structural violence of occupation and the direct violence of bombs and bombing, terror and torture. An oscillation between those two. Also, listen to this. The probability, he was writing in 2000, the probability of escalation of civil war within Israel between moderates and fundamentalists. That was written almost 25 years ago, completely true of the present time, both of those lines. And so again, the second foundation is looking at one's conditioning. And again, very important to do in coming to this situation. Very, very, very crucial. And the third foundation is working with difficult emotions. Really crucial. Difficult emotions, difficult thoughts. Maybe we get triggered by what friends say or what we see in the news, one side or the other. Again, this is more inner work. Can I work with this? I'm in a group that meets with Jewish Buddhist practitioners. We had a meeting about a week ago, and I didn't experience it in this way, but a number of people in that group who are Jewish, I think this is very true in Israel, are very much triggered so that, as it were, the trauma of the Holocaust is close by. That came up with these Jewish Americans. This is what they were experiencing, right? And very much the trauma is also there for Palestinians, whether they're in the West Bank or, of course, there's the direct trauma of the violence in Gaza. And this is from someone who's given a lot of wisdom on Israel-Palestine, in my view, Michael Lerner, Rabbi Michael Lerner, who lives in Berkeley. He wrote this almost 20 years ago. Each side, the Jewish Israelis and the Palestinians, each became blind to the other's legitimate needs. The eyes of both Israelis and Palestinians are so glazed over by the immediacy of painful historical memories that they have not been able to envision new possibilities that might bring both communities the peace they actually desire. Huge traumas have constricted the abilities of Israelis and Palestinians to see and act upon what is in their best interest. The task is to heal the trauma. That healing is not just political or psychological, but also spiritual. And we have ways to practice that, but it's as it were, the whole of Israel-Palestine needs periods of trauma work, needs ways of working with this. We need that if we are impacted by the situation in significant ways. That's a part of it. And I know for myself, just being with the difficult emotions as a practitioner has been really crucial in being able to be with the situation. You know, to how many people have also had difficult emotions, difficult thoughts, reactivity, all sorts of things in relation to the situation. Yeah, it looks like most of us, you know, and doing this work, if we're with friends who have different views or we're going to meet with them over the holidays, can we do that? The fourth guideline is to work with heart practices. It could be almost a practice to be with the news, maybe before and or after, to bring in compassion practice at the horrific suffering. You know, just that is there, unimaginable. I mean, it's as if, you know, the Hamas attacks were as if an army came into our neighborhood and killed everyone. Can you imagine that where you live? That's what it was like, right? And on the other side, can you imagine carpet bombing, which I heard that in northern Gaza, 50% of the buildings are destroyed or ruined beyond repair. And of course, thousands and thousands dead. Can you imagine carpet bombing of your neighborhood? Unimaginable, right? And so can we do these heart practices, even though it may feel separate from the situation? Wishing, says the Metta Sutta, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. I think related to all this as a part of the inner foundation is being careful about how much one takes in, right? How many people have actually been working with that with some care? Yeah, being careful with that. That's crucial. Going now to the more outer foundations, the fifth is remembering the teachings about Buddha nature, about everyone having at their core wisdom, love, the potential for awakening. And we actually find this view actually in all of the great religious traditions, not just Buddhism. And it can be really helpful to know that at the heart, in this case of Judaism and Islam, are teachings that are very similar. From Exodus, you shall not wrong a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were aliens in Egypt. From the great Jewish mystical text, the Zohar, the world shall be built on love. And then it quotes Psalms, by this the world endures. And from the Islamic tradition, the Prophet Muhammad said, shall I not tell you of something which if you do it, you will love one another? Spread the greetings of salam, or peace, among yourselves. Rumi, the great Islamic poet, love is the water of life. Drink it down with heart and soul. So this is remembering this, even though the world may seem far away. So again, we're trying to ourselves be beacons or lights in a difficult and even we might say dark time. Related to this is the sixth guideline, really coming out of this vision of universal metta, the beloved community. Dr. King says, The end is reconciliation. So this is really remembering that the aim in conflicts is reconciliation, connection, mutual understanding. And then also, as I brought out last time, holding a vision to meet the needs, the genuine needs of all concerned, developing what we can call a win-win model, avoiding the tendency to go into a win-lose model. You know, and so in my view, this would mean for Israel-Palestine, a vision of meeting the deep needs for Israel, our security, especially for the Palestinians, sovereignty, freedom, and justice. It's not very hard, actually, to know potential solutions which meet the needs of all. I would say some version of a two-state solution with generosity in terms of giving more land to the Palestinians, including from neighboring countries, something like that, keeping that vision alive. And I found that the vision is actually there in a lot of people, but they're somewhat on the margins. You know, that, for example, I've been very inspired by friends in Israel. I think I mentioned one friend maybe last time. They are going every day into the West Bank, helping their Palestinian friends with the olive harvest and sharing the pain together. And in the past, they've developed very close relationships through many years of connection and helping, really coming to understand one another. There's a group called Combatants for Peace, former Israeli soldiers, former Palestinian militants who come together, espouse nonviolence, and look to find solutions that meet the needs of all. They say, we are a movement based on nonviolent activism designed to advance the termination of the occupation and to provide a foundation for relations between the two peoples subsequent to a peace agreement. Our ultimate goal is to end the occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state, two states living side by side in peace and cooperation. Another organization, some of you know, Families of the Bereaved, those who've lost family members, coming together to work together in these ways. Giving a vision of working together, sharing the pain and sharing the vision. Right? And I just want to make one comment, which I haven't made, that I don't want to suggest that even though there's pain and trauma on both sides, very crucial to know that there's an asymmetry of power, which is rather severe. So it's not simply two sides coming together. There is a power imbalance which plays a large role. So how can that vision be really developed and expressed? And let me see if I can find wanted to read something from friends. Let's see where this is. This is from some friends who have developed over the years close relationships with Palestinians and working together. In the years ahead, we will continue to work as we have until now. Our basis is, on the one hand, personal relations that are being created us between us and our partners in two villages, Walaja and Deristia. And on the other hand, the fact that we are part of a marvelous sangha of Dharma practitioners. We are continuing to take action, both to engender a better reality and awakening our practitioner friends to the responsibility that devolves on us all to do good in the world. And related to that is the seventh foundation, which I've called really grounding in ethics, grounding in non-harming. And I've been particularly inspired by Palestinian nonviolent activists who hold that vision and commit to nonviolence. One of the great leaders is Mubarak Awad, originally from Bethlehem, a great nonviolent activist. He says each party must stop using violence and must commit to living and working with each other as neighbors. Both are motivated by perceptions of security and historical identity. I could say a lot more there, and it really also dovetails with my last guideline about bringing nonviolence into the larger social realm, but that grounding for us in non-harming is a way, again, my motivation here, partly to bring our practice to an understanding of what would be skillful in the situation, and partly to develop skills in being with others with different views. And the eighth guideline is particularly useful. It's the guideline of empathy, which we've gone into in some depth. And this is the ability to tune in to what matters for the other person, even with a difference of view. Empathy can totally coexist with disagreements, but can we have our hearts open to know what's important for the other person? You know, the teachings here are partly based on nonviolent communication, that every action, every view has a genuine need. We might disagree with the view or the strategy, but there's going to be something genuine there, and our empathy helps us tune in. You know, can I do that? You know, I think I've told this story at least once or twice, but I don't know about recently. About 20 years ago, was part of a retreat at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I don't know if I mentioned this last week. Did I mention it last week? Yep, sounds like it did. So I'll be brief. That we met with the scientists and technicians, and some of us just got into arguments, and some of us tried to be empathic, even though we deeply disagreed. Empathy has that power. It's something we can practice across views. Really, really crucial. The ninth is skillful speech practice. And again, I won't go into so much detail. And then the 10th is nonviolent social action, which is really an extension of that grounding in ethics. And I mentioned how, you know, I've been very inspired by those who have received a lot of pain, and yet they don't pass on the pain. This is the essence of our practice. This is the essence of the nonviolence of Gandhi and King. It's not shooting the second arrow. It's really a direct expression of the Dharma. And so let me finish with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. He had a very similar approach during the Vietnam War, even though, again, in Vietnam, there was an asymmetry of power. And you could have arguments about one side being right, one side being wrong. Thich Nhat Hanh said, "We were able to understand the suffering of both sides. We try to be open to both, to understand this side and to understand that side, to be one with both of them. We did not take a side, even though the whole world took sides. We wanted reconciliation. Reconciliation is to understand both sides." So thank you for your attention. Thank you for letting me have the liberty to explore this. I could talk for a few more hours on this and explore this with you, but I wanted to share that. And again, the emphasis is on keeping grounded in our practice. That's been my intention. Let me invite just a moment of being quiet, and then we can talk together. So let me invite any sharing, any questions, some maybe sharing how you've worked with the situation, sharing about how you worked with conflict in the last week. It doesn't have to be entirely on this. And again, we'll try to, it's perfectly fine to have some disagreement with what I said. Alice, please.
So I really didn't want to go to that, if that's okay. I really appreciate your talk, but I would like to know if you know of any way that we can send money, give support, prime time, advertise and celebrate any of these groups that are following these foundations. If you know of any way that we could push that and make that more something that we're hearing more about instead of all the troubles.
Beautiful, very concrete form, yeah. Give support to organizations that are carrying the vision. You know, I would say look up the group. They should have a way, Combatants for Peace. That's one of the groups I named. And the other, let me find the technical term of the other organization is, yeah. It's sometimes called the Bereaved Family Forum.
Thank you very much.
I should get it to you. And, you know, so those are two wonderful organizations. Again, I think Michael Lerner, Rabbi Michael Lerner and Rabbi Katzavitz are doing very good work with Tikkun, which is a magazine. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Alice. That's a very significant way to help to really take these groups out of the margins. I think that's something like that has to happen. That has to be a solution, right? That groups like that and people who are marginal now somehow take, you know, gain more centrality. But there also has to be a lot of healing because there's so much pain, so much trauma. It's hard to go to those healing perspectives or visionary perspectives when there's so much pain. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Please, Kylie. Yeah.
Hi, Donald. I really just feel very compelled to just thank you and bless you for such a brave and honest and sensitive reading of the situation that is so hard to come by in this world of polarized media and response. And my gosh, it really gives me hope when I hear you speak, and I'm also reminded of that wonderful quote from Lao Tzu who said, for there to be peace in the world, there must be peace in the nations. There must be peace in the states. And he goes through from the states to the cities, to the neighborhoods, to the home. For there to be peace in the home, there must be peace in the heart. And there's that direct connection between global peace and peace in the heart. And that's just becoming more and more prominent and relevant, I think. And just thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Kylie, so much as well. And just, I think almost, you know, everywhere, you know, keeping our practice strong and then being able to start bringing it, into challenging situations or differences or conflicts in our communities and even in our larger world, our larger society, right? What would it be like if we had, several million people holding a vision like that, right? And trying to bring that into different situations. So sometimes it can feel lonely. To be honest, I have sometimes felt lonely. And, you know, part of my practice is being with that. Has anyone also felt lonely? You know, with so much of this happening, you know, and feeling, okay, they're taking a side. Even a number of Buddhist groups seemed to me to have had one-sided perspectives, right? And I felt sometimes lonely and sad, a lot of sadness. And so we have our practices for that. But yeah, I think it's the only way things really shift. Yeah. Patty, please.
Thank you, Donald. I came across a poem this week, and I don't remember who sent it. It was a Buddhist teacher, but I get so much mail, I can't remember where it started. But it's a poem by a rabbi named Erwin Keller, and it's called Taking Sides. And I encourage everyone to look for that. Just Google Taking Sides, Erwin Keller. He basically says, don't ask me to wave a flag unless it's a flag of peace. Don't ask me to take a side unless it's the side of peace. Don't ask me to sing an anthem unless it's an anthem of peace. And he basically encapsulates the message of empathy in this beautiful poem.
Wow. That's powerful. Thank you. Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, please, Deborah.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you. And I believe that poem that Patty just mentioned might be in our newsletter, which is coming out in a few weeks. I don't feel lonely. I feel numbed in the upper part of my brain. Yeah. I just feel numbed. I have, my Jewish ancestors came through England via Poland on both sides of my family, and they grew up in a lot of poverty and abuse and anxiety, and they all landed eventually in New York. My father was a first generation immigrant here, and I have relatives in Israel. My father's youngest brother was one of the first kibbutzniks in Israel after World War II, and of course he had children and they have grandchildren now. And I have cousins in Israel, in England. I can't discuss this. The only way I can practice with it when I'm talking to people who have such strong feelings is to listen.
Yeah.
I just only can listen. I have some Jewish friends who hold my values and hold my views and get the nightmare that's going on and has been going on for so many decades now for the Palestinian people. Makes me very upset. So I try not to think about it too often. But the only way I can really stay in connection with these friends and relatives who either have lived in Israel or very connected to the Israeli parts of our is just to listen. And as you say, to just give them empathy, because they're upset, they're hurting, and I don't want to have discombobulation with them, and I'm not in this lifetime going to change their minds or hearts. So maybe that's cowardice, but or lack of NVC training or something, but it's the only way I can cope with it with these few people. And thank you for this talk. It's very beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. There's a lot there in what you say. And, you know, wonderful that you can have the approach of listening when you have a sense that they might not be interested mm-hmm. in your perspective. Mm-hmm. And maybe at some point they would be. You know, but your intuition is that that's there. The hurting makes that very hard, right? And then also pointing out that there can be the numbness, right? That you were saying, you know, just from the level of pain and the level of suffering in the news, it's almost like we'd have to again do practice for 5 or 10 minutes after reading the news for 5 minutes, right?
It's just that it never seems to change. I mean, this is more than 2,000 years old, right? I mean, the whole thing with
the anti-Semitism, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole thing with tribalism, right? It goes back thousands of years, does it not? I mean, everywhere. So in this nation and other nations, and I don't
know. Well, it's, I mean, actually, you know, if you go back to 1900, there've always been Jews in what we, you know, in the area we call Israel-Palestine now, but there were relatively small number of Jews. I think 1900, it would have been about 6 or 7% of the population. And the relations with people we now call Palestinians, very, very harmonious. They got along very, very well. There was zero conflict. And everything that's been hard has happened since then, particularly starting around the 1920s.
My uncle, Henry, who became Uncle Zvi, talked about how he and his wife, a Holocaust survivor, and their children played with their Palestinian neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And even right now, they're, you know, in some of the cities in Israel, like Jaffa and Haifa and Acre, where there's a lot of intermixing between Israeli Palestinians and Israeli Jews. So there's some hopeful things there. Let me make sure we have time. Maybe last one will be Liz, please.
Hi, thanks for your talk. It takes a lot of courage to stand up on these issues. For instance, students at different colleges are being attacked. Teachers are being threatened.
Yeah.
And one needs a lot of support to do this. And the other thing is to work with one's own pain.
Yeah.
Very, very important to have self-compassion. Because there will be pain involved in this. And if one doesn't know how to work with it, that doesn't help. So self-compassion is very, very important. A lot of courage, and takes a lot of courage.
Yeah.
A lot of courage to stand up.
Beautiful, Liz. Yeah. So, yeah, courage really applies, I think, to almost all the foundations. And then particularly working with the difficult emotions, the pain, bringing in a lot of self-compassion. You know, when we, you know, particularly if, you know, we have, you know, those of us with Jewish ancestry, it's very, very deep. You know, there's a beautiful book on intergenerational Jewish trauma by Rabbi Tirzah Firestone. It's called Wounds into Wisdom, a very powerful book that, if you don't know it, it could be helpful. But it's, I know in my own being, there's a lot there and a lot of pain, as you suggest, Liz. So thank you.